listening
to the CD Baby.
CD Baby.
CD Baby.
DIY
Musician.
Musician Podcast.
Hey there, and welcome to episode number 228 of the CD Baby DIY Musician Podcast. My name is Kevin Bruner, and joining me is Chris Robley. Chris, how are you?
I'm great, and it was nice to see you in Montreal. And now that we've been back to work for a little while, we're both sort of randomly at the same time going on vacation. Starting tomorrow. Not together.
No, but that would be nice. We should plan that sometime.
Yeah, I'll meet you in Hawaii.
We need to get on the cruise train. Everyone is doing cruises. We should do a DIY musician cruise.
In 2020, the conference should just be on a cruise ship.
Yeah, we'll have concerts, seminars during the day, and plenty of adult beverages and lounging by the pool and stopping at exotic islands. Who doesn't want to be on that boat? I may ask them to never go back to the port. Just keep sailing. Yes, it was nice to see you in Montreal. Our last episode of the podcast was recorded at Folk Alliance in Montreal. It was like a frigid 8 degrees outside, but inside it was warm and toasty with lots of great music and discussion. And man, I'd never been to Folk Alliance before. You had told me about it many, many times. It was amazing. I had such a good time. I was sad to leave.
I know I've said this now a few times, but besides our conference, it is my favorite music event of the year. It's just like full of all the things that music should always be about. Like, yep. You know, people singing together, enjoyment, meaningful, you know, messages in the music, and like, you know, it's definitely a business conference, and you know, it's people are there to get gigs and whatever other needs they have, but like, I feel like that it definitely takes a back seat to just the music making and the community.
Yeah. Yeah. I laughed. I cried. I had moving moments. I watched a show on a bed with you. I mean, we were
not a TV show, an actual concert. No.
Yeah. The thing that's amazing is they take over multiple floors of the hotel, like entire floors. And when you told me this, I had this picture in my head of like, I don't know. It just seemed really stale or I don't know. That's not the word I'm looking for, but just seemed like, I don't know. But when I walked off the elevator, it looked like I was at a college dorm like party. There's posters from floor to ceiling lining the entire hallway of a very nice hotel, which I can't believe they let them do that in the first place.
Right.
Every single room is a different show. And some of them, they move the beds out, and some of them, like in we had a showcase room and we had the beds in there. So people are piled on the beds together. And, you know, there's like 30 people stuffed in a hotel room while someone's doing a showcase. And I saw some amazing music, had a blast.
Yeah, I don't think it's an exaggeration to say that there's probably 100 or more like showcases happening at once, because there's like two or three floors of hotel rooms.
Yeah. There's three floors going at once, and two of them are just hotel rooms, and yeah, it's amazing. So you just bounce from room to room, and yeah, such a good time. Next year it's going to be in New Orleans in January, and
which is perfect for me.
Yes, perfect for anyone who's living further north like we do. And I can't wait to go back, and CD Baby will have a big presence there again. So you know, and it works out perfectly. You can go to New Orleans in January, then you can come see us in Valencia in April, and then us in Austin in the summer.
Yeah.
That's your whole year plan.
They go on the DIY circuit.
Yeah. And then whenever the cruise happens, we'll figure that one out. So,
all right.
Yeah, Folk Alliance was great. And speaking of it being so cold outside, like in Montreal, it was, when I arrived, it was 8 degrees and had 2 feet of snow. You know where it's not cold right now, Chris?
In Valencia, Spain.
You are correct. I was on the phone with them this morning and it was 80 degrees.
Whoa.
And I cannot wait to go to the DIY Musician Conference in Valencia, Spain at the Berkeley campus there. It is going to be April 6th and 7th. You should go. If you were in Europe, like, tickets, plane tickets, train tickets, they're like €5 practically to get there. Not that quite that cheap, but they are cheap. But our conference is only €59 and it's a steal. And you should be there. It'll be most likely warm. The weather can be variable that time of year. Not guaranteed that it'll be 80, but it is such a great spot there on the Mediterranean Sea. And Valencia is a great town. Chris and I will be there. We'll do a live podcast taping and we'll just have a good time. So yeah, check that out. DIYMusicianCon.com to get your tickets. And then, you know, Austin is coming up August 16th through 18th for the big show down in Austin, the big DIY Musician Conference. And that is, tickets right now are $99 and they're going to go up very soon. The early bird is almost over. So DIYMusicianCon.com. Get your tickets to places that are much, much warmer than what I'm experiencing right now. It's snowing in Portland again. I cannot believe this. That's it's like crazy. A thing now.
So yeah. Much snow. I had one other reason people should act now on the Austin conference, besides just the price about to go up a little bit, which is that if you get an early bird ticket, you have sort of priority access to apply to do a showcase. So if you want to play, your chances are better at getting a slot if you get your ticket now.
Yep. Yeah, and we have more performance opportunities this year. We have a venue for all three nights, and this venue has two stages, and it's an amazing place. You can Google it. It's called Cheer Up Charlie's. There's an indoor stage and an outdoor festival-type stage all on this property that's right downtown. It's a cool spot. I was there just a couple months ago hanging out. I will be there, probably stop by at South by Southwest when I'm there in March. And you will want to be on that stage. Trust me. So just get your ticket now. All right. This episode of the podcast, it's something that's kind of been this theme that when I talk to artists, it seems to be this theme that especially new artists entering the market where they have this initial experience recording that is just very frustrating, doesn't go as they had hoped, didn't really understand what they were getting themselves into. And a lot of times it comes down to the fact of they didn't understand how to find a producer. And, you know, we were talking to somebody at Folk Alliance who was going through this issue. And we thought,
I don't want to cut you off here, but it was a late night conversation over drinks where she kept asking us a number of questions saying, so this was my experience. Is that normal? And we'd both just shake our heads and say, no. And then she'd ask another question. Is that normal?
Yeah.
No. No,
no, no. Yes.
And, that, well, and actually, I shouldn't say it's not normal, but it's not professional. It's not how things should be. Sadly, correct. It is normal.
Actually, yes. And this person, we'll call her Harmony with an I to protect her identity. yes, there was even some follow-up conversations after that. And where, again, is this normal? I said, well, it happens more often than to artists than should, but it's not normal in the professional sense. But anyway, so a lot of it comes down to finding a producer. And so in this episode of the podcast, we're going to talk about how you find a producer or engineer, who they are, what they're supposed to do, what those agreements should look like, how to know if you're getting ripped off, or how do you know you're in a good situation? Because a lot of times the scenario is you're an independent artist, you're entering the market, or maybe you've done a few records and you go out into the marketplace to find somebody to help you record. And a lot of times I think artists either just grab the first person they find and work with them, or they're in a smaller town and have less options. And so just by where they're located, get kind of stuck with people who may not have their best interest in mind. So we're going to talk about that. What should we title this episode, Chris? I didn't think of a title.
How to find a producer that isn't, I don't know. I had a whole bunch of bad words come to my imagination and I should keep them to myself. That won't drive you mad.
There you go. How to find a producer that won't drive you mad. That's how these things get named on the podcast. So we're going to talk through that. Before we dive into all that, Chris, I thought it might be good for us to talk about some of our experiences real quick, like the different types of producers that we've worked with and the different sort of recording situations we've been in, just so people have context for, you know, our experience. You want to go first?
Yeah, sure. So like early on in like high school and college bands, I had a couple chances to go to like a studio. And that was just this weird thing of like, someone in the band found a guy that had a studio. We paid him some money. They didn't give a shit. We went, because I'm sure we were terrible. Recorded, whatever. Those aren't the experiences I even really remember that well. But when it really came down to like me being a performer and wanting to make a serious record, I basically just looked up people in the region that, actually, first I should say, I started by looking at the credits of local bands' albums that I really liked and thought sounded good. And then I just reached out to those people. So that kind of began a process of me of recording most of my stuff in studios. So I've worked with probably five or six different producers / engineers. I think later we can sort of define those terms better, but
yeah.
So yeah, I've worked with a number of different people and put out, I don't know how many records, 6, 7, something like that. Anything from what was like someone's home studio, you know, they had serious gear and put a lot of effort into it, but essentially it was just in their basement, to like, you know, a probably $1 million or more. I don't even know. A huge room with tons of gear. So yeah, that's kind of my studio experience in a nutshell.
Yeah. On my side, you know, I went to Belmont University in Nashville, and my first experience with like a professionally run studio was there at the school. And, you know, you had to go through classes and engineer on a project, and then you had to produce a project. By project, I mean like a song. And that was for class. And so kind of got experience of how it should work. Then when Small Town Poets, when we got signed, we recorded at Ardent Studios in Memphis, a very storied studio that's a very cool spot. People like R.E.M. and Stevie Ray Vaughan and all these kind of guys had recorded there. And we worked with a producer named John Hampton. And very different experience than I expected. His producing style, very laid back. We did a couple records with him. He had produced, I think I mentioned, he produced the Gin Blossoms. I don't think I said that yet. He produced the Gin Blossoms. That was kind of his biggest production credits. He'd worked on a bunch of other big records. Like he was doing Robert Cray and Jimmy Vaughn and a bunch of guys like that. But, and then when I did my first independent project, it was here in the Portland area, a project that's still on CD Baby, a band name called The Covering. The guy that produced it, he was, you know, just doing independent stuff at the time, later moved to Nashville, and just 2 weeks ago won a Grammy for Album of the Year. He mixed on the Casey Musgraves record. So it was kind of interesting to have worked with somebody like that years ago. That was like back in 2003 when he was really just starting to get momentum going. And then did a few sort of self-produced things with the band Hello Morning, and then Small Town Poets. We've been working with somebody who's also sort of like the sixth honorary member of the band. His name is Matt Goldman, who he's got a couple platinum record credits to his name, but all very different experiences. But also there's some common themes between all of them as far as when you're working with people that are professionals as opposed to some of the people that are trying to take advantage of independent artists. And so we're going to talk about that today. And let's start it off with Chris talking about what even a producer is. And, you know, maybe the difference between a producer and an engineer, because a lot of times today, especially now, it can be a big gray area of what the difference is between the two of them. And when someone's calling them a producer, the sort of expectations of the role compared to someone who's just offering up their services as an engineer.
Sure. Okay. So I forgot to mention in our little summary there that I've actually produced records for other artists as well. So I have been a producer. So from my perspective, I feel like the job of a producer is to be in charge of the record coming out in a way that is, you know, meets the kind of mission statement of the artist or the band, or if you're, you know, unfortunately controlled by a label, to meet the mission statement of what the label expects. But, and I think that the engineer, you know, is the sort of technician of capturing the sounds, you know, knowing which mics to choose, mic placement, what effects to put these signals through and all that sort of stuff on the way in. The producer generally has more of like a global view of the song and the vibe and the arrangement, and could be as hands-off as sort of sitting there and nodding yes or no, or you know, for a certain take and be like, no, that didn't capture it, do it again. Or it could be super hands-on and be arranging, could be playing with the band, could be, you know, very, very, hands-on. And I think you had compared the producer to like the director of a film.
Yeah.
Which I think is fair. I mean, I think directors sometimes, that is fair. I guess I'm thinking of director writers who are, then they combine producer role with like almost the songwriter or artist role. But yeah, another thing we should probably clarify is in the hip hop and EDM world and pop world to some degree now, producers kind of are defined a little bit different than I think what the standard definition was for, you know, the second half of the 20th century, which was more what I just described. Now the producer in those genres is probably also a songwriter in the sense that they might be creating the music and the beats and stuff that some other collaborators work with to have a finished song. So that actually on the DIY musician blog is one of the most common sort of areas of questioning that I get. It's sort of like, who owns what in that capacity? Are they a songwriter? Yeah. Are they not a songwriter? So yeah, that's.
Yeah. The term producer has gotten a little fuzzy with like what you said with EDM, hip hop, where sometimes that term producer gets used as in I'm someone, a hip hop artist needs a track to rap over. I am producing that track, meaning like I am supplying that track. I make it and I supply it. And you know, there's, it's a wide spectrum, but I'm just trying to, you know, simplify so people understand if they're even talking to somebody, because I talk to people all the time now that someone will say, I'm a producer. They're not intending to mean it, for it to mean that they work with other artists and help this rock artist define their sound. Then they go help this country artist define their sound, like a Rick Rubin or somebody, you know, who is a very well-known established producer where that's what he does. The record company hires him in order to help an artist create an album that has their own sound and identity and helps them refine the music. So it's important to even know what that is and why I think it's important to also know the difference between an engineer and a producer is a lot of engineers come up, a lot of producers come up through the ranks as engineers, and that's where they spend a lot of their time. Like an engineer will spend a lot of time maybe dialing sounds and getting good drum sounds and good guitar sounds, but they might not be responsible for the overall arrangements of the song or telling the artist that the way they're singing isn't that great, or, you know, they might just be dialing in sounds. But then over time, a lot of those guys just get so much experience that they start stepping into the producer role, and that's how a lot of them come up through the ranks. So it's pretty common today that if you're working with a producer, especially if they have their own studio, that they're also an engineer. And so typically you're getting one person that doing both roles in that situation.
That's a good point. And it's something, that's something I hadn't thought of when I was giving my little recording summary. I have actually never hired a producer in quotes. I've always, every single album I've made has been hiring basically first and foremost an engineer, but one that I know can also sort of, when I need them to, act as the producer. So in a way they've been like engineers and sounding boards and or like co-produce. I generally credit the album as like produced by me and the engineer. But so I've actually never, that's an interesting point. I've never worked with someone who's solely the producer as well as an engineer. I mean, and that's a budgetary thing too for like a lot of it indie is. Projects. You're not like you have endless funds to just hire like this huge team.
Yeah. That was what was interesting about the Small Town Poets, our label days. Those albums, our producer was just the producer. He also did come up through the ranks as an engineer, but at that time, especially this was the mid to late 90s, it was pretty common like in Nashville to have, Nashville was where I was living, but we were recording in Memphis. But in the Nashville scene, it was common to have a producer that maybe didn't have production or engineering experience. Maybe they were a very accomplished songwriter or had been an artist themselves and just had good ideas. And so they were hired into a production role. But yeah, so a lot of times these days, the producer and engineer can be one. And I think it's important to understand those things, because when you go to start talking about the actual process and what you're going to pay them for, you need to understand what job you're asking them to do, because that's where a lot of confusion comes in. And I think a lot of frustration and feeling like you didn't get what you thought you were going to get. So it's really important to understand who it is that you're hiring. And so we're going to get into more details about what roles they should be doing and what they shouldn't be doing as we talk through. But let's start with, how do you find a producer? You had sort of mentioned that a little bit when you started talking about some of the stuff you had done, Chris. But
yeah,
tell us how you look for people.
So for me, it was very sort of Portland, Oregon or Pacific Northwest centric, because I knew those are the studios I could get to. So my first solo record, I just really liked the Decemberists, and I looked on their record and I saw that their album was, I forget if they credited him as a producer, I think they did, but basically this engineer named Adam Selzer, who had a studio called Type Foundry, and I liked the Decemberists record. I bought one of his own record, like he has a band or had a band called Norfolk and Western. I liked that stuff. So I was like, okay, I'm going to reach out to this guy. So I went on the website for the studio and sent a, you know, cold email. Now I was super timid and green and all this and terrified. And he wrote back and was like, well, yeah, let's like, why don't you come over to my house for like an hour and like play me a couple songs. And, you know, he didn't want to say yes to something until he had knew whether he could stand it or not, or maybe even stand working with me. So I did, and I was so terrified. I went to his house one afternoon with my guitar, and I got it out. And like, I'm one of those people who, like, if I'm on a big stage, I'm like pretty very comfortable. And if I'm in like a little room, like the hotel room at Folk Alliance, like I'm terrified there. It's like the more intimate, the worse for me. So, and this is like,
those are the hardest. Yeah.
And so this was me playing brand new songs that pretty much no one had ever heard, with this guy standing, you know, 5 feet in front of me, or, you know, sitting across from me. And I'm like, he's looking, he's listening. He looks like dead inside. What's happening? I'm like sweating and my voice is shaking. And he was like, cool, all right, this will be fun. Like, what's your like timeline and budget or whatever? And would that work? And we discussed, you know, basically the project, and it worked out. I went in, and 4 days later I had my first solo record done. And that kind of led me, I worked with him again on a few other projects that also led me to some related people, like in his sphere. Like, he had worked with the Decemberists and M Ward, and you know, a lot of sort of Northwest bands like that. And so I had met other people who had engineered those bands and worked with them. So then I sort of branched out till I had 3 or 4 producer engineers, like in this roster of folks I could call. And I kept working with all of them kind of on and off. And the only thing that I think that led me to sort of hop from one to the other wasn't anything about their professionalism. It was just like, okay, I know what they do. What would happen if I worked with someone else? And then, you know, just trying new things. And then eventually I'd want to get back to some other, a previous producer's methods or something. So it's sort of just hopping around.
Yeah. So it started by looking at liner notes, which is one of the things I have, like, of a band. If there's a band that you like, and this has gotten a little harder in the digital world, especially if it's indie artists in your space, so you might have to email some people instead of just looking at liner notes. Like, if there's an album that you like the sound of it, find out who produced it, especially if it's somebody from your region. And then asking other bands and artists who they're using, you know, that's part of that. One of the suggestions I've had is that talking to reputable studios for recommendations, because a lot of times the studio owner may not be a producer, or they might engineer, or they just might be too busy and they can't, or too expensive but they might be a good place for you to start and ask somebody, who do you recommend using?
That goes for both tracking studio work as well as mastering and everything else. I remember a couple of years ago, I wrote to Bob Ludwig, because he's nearby where I live, to see just what it would cost to master a record. And it was like $1 billion because he's the best mastering engineer in the world. But he'd said, hey, if that's not in your range, you should consider these people who work out of here too. And, way more affordable, but also like highly recommended.
Yeah. And you know, that's a good point about you. You emailed one of the, you are correct that he's like the top earning mastering engineer of all time. It's surprising how oftentimes a big name producer will potentially get back to you, but a lot of times they'll have gaps in their schedule between, especially if they're working like on label projects, they might have a 2-week gap in their schedule or 1-week gap in their schedule and they want to be working, but they know they're not going to get a big paying label project for a week. So they might take on an independent artist project, or, you know, like you said, they might recommend somebody who's also in their network that they respect and see as an up and comer that would be in your price range. So that's always another good way to go. And then also an engineer that might be ready to step into the producer role. Maybe like if you have been in a situation where there's a producer and engineer, or you've been working at a studio where there's several engineers and you've just built a good relationship with somebody and like the sounds they get, they might be ready to step into that role. And
I think, our friend Jeff Saltzman, I'm pretty sure he had this experience, although I might be misremembering, but that sort of situation where he'd come up in a studio and was like a tape op and then an engineer or whatever. And then it was like after hours recording, I think he was, you know, it's like you'd get like a, when he was still learning, sort of like you'd give friends or whatever, you know, a discounted rate to go in late at night and they get to make a record on a budget while he also gets to kind of experiment and learn his craft a little bit too. I don't know if you should necessarily like seek that out as an opportunity, because who knows if the person's reliable, but in his case, he is a great engineer.
Yeah, that's a good point that there might be.
Before people write him, I should say he doesn't do that anymore. He's got his own daytime studio hours now.
But that is a good point that a lot of times there's guys that are working on higher profile records and they're having to do things that maybe aren't what they want to do just to pay the bills, that maybe you can get them late night for and let them say, hey, let's just get in there and experiment. It might not be what you want to do for your first project, because it might be something where you're like, this is really weird, this isn't what I want. But it could be an opportunity once you've built a relationship with somebody like, hey, let's just go in there and mess around, and they'll give you, you know, maybe a reduced rate because it's learning for them as well. They just need some, you know, more experience with other things and just the ability to try new stuff themselves. So those are some of the ways that you can find a producer or engineer. But those are some of the ways that I would recommend going about it. And again, if you are in a remote part of the world, it's going to be a challenge to find somebody. But you would be surprised where some fancy, famous studios are. And
in the middle of nowhere. Know. It's crazy. Yes. Like destination yes. studios for, you know, rich and famous people who can fly in for a week. And
yeah. So you never know what might be around you that you just haven't come across, that hasn't been on your radar. So it's good to start asking around and build that network. And, you know, I think that takes us into what should I expect from working with a producer? And I was going to say, what led me into that is like, it's okay to go out and ask to go out and meet a producer at their studio or the studio of their choice. Cause you know, you could be working with a producer that doesn't really own a studio, but they have some studios that they prefer to work out of. It's okay to ask to stop by and observe a session. Because really it should be about your musical vision or an agreed upon vision. You shouldn't be going into a situation not knowing what this person's typical musical identity is, if they have one as a producer.
Yeah.
And that would be terrifying.
Well, to go along with that about it being okay to kind of, what would you say, audit their recording session or just to have a conversation with them, it's also okay to sort of shop around a little bit. Like one of the bands I produced a record for, Little Beirut, they, I forget if they called or emailed me or whatever, and they said, hey, do you want to go out for drinks? Because we are interested in you producing our record, but we're also talking to three or four other people and we want to like see who fits the best or whatever. So I went out to drinks. We hung out for like 3 hours and talked about music, and ultimately it worked out that they picked me to do the record, which is cool. But like, I think that's fine if you're upfront with people and be like, hey, I'm not exactly sure who I want to work with, but I'm considering you, like, feel free to shop around.
Yeah. And they all have different temperaments and working styles. And in fact, when Small Town Poets, when we were in the process of getting signed, our bass player, Miguel, was playing bass for this other artist who was in the studio doing her first record for a label. And the person that they had producing it was somebody who had been an engineer on some mega records, like he had engineered some U2 records and things like that. And he was starting to move into a producer role. And it was crazy what Miguel was saying. Like they spent like a week just in a rehearsal space with this producer. And he was like, every single note had to be exact. Everything was like, it just sounded like something that would make me cry. And so I was really nervous going into our, you know, we were going to Arden Studios. We're going to record with John Hampton, and totally different experience, super laid back guy. He was more about the, it feeling good, you know, and how the feel of the song, wasn't worried about everything being super precise, even though we were playing to a click and all that kind of stuff, but very different. And one experience, I think, you know, the one we had suited us. The one that that other artist was having that our bass player was playing with, you know, he felt like he got a lot better as a bass player because of it. But also at the same time, it was high pressure and very tense, he said. And that's not what I want to experience in the studio. So they can all be very different. So you got to, that's, it's important that you find somebody that's going to match your working style. Maybe you like that intensity. Maybe you don't. You got to get up there and perform and get the tracks down, and a lot of times think on the spot and have creativity flow on the spot. And if it's somebody that intimidates you or you feel threatened by or just bad vibes, it's going to make it a challenge. And that's, it's okay to vet that stuff.
Yeah. And I think another thing is being aware of what kills momentum for you. Maybe that's sort of what you're saying, but like time is money in the studio. So if someone is, you know, maybe overly meticulous, that could be good or bad, but basically you probably need to lean on your producer in a way to be the person who tells you when good enough is good enough and it's time to move on. So if they're, you know, disappearing down a rabbit hole, you either, you know, well, you should feel empowered to basically make that decision and say like, okay, this is good, let's move on.
Yeah. Which brings me to one of my points of, you are not their employee.
Oh God. Yes.
Which
this is like that's the summary of all these nightmare stories we hear. It's like, wait, are you working for them or are they working for you? You're paying them, right?
Yes. And that's what many of the, is this normal? That late night drink conversation we were having in Montreal. It was like, well, it happens a lot, but I wouldn't say that's what's supposed to happen. So I'm going to say that's not normal. Yes, you are not their employee. You are hiring them to produce your music. Now, ideally, you are getting somebody that has some qualifications and some talents and abilities that you are leaning on to help you, to partner with you, to make an album that is better than what you could just do on your own. But at the end of the day, you are paying them, and that's important to remember because sometimes it feels like you are working for them. And so
and that doesn't mean they have to, that they can't resist you creatively. Like I think sometimes for me personally, if I ever had a budget, I would want to pay a producer so that they would fight me in a healthy way, you know, like challenge my ideas, tell me when I'm going overboard, all that stuff. But the veto power should always be with you because they're, well, you're the client, but you know, I don't think it needs to be like a one of those 70s rock documentaries where like the producer and the artist are like throwing punches and stuff, but like
the good old days.
I think that the age of the rock star is over anyway, so now everyone has to just be nice.
Back then they'd just do a line of coke and everybody be happy again.
Yeah, right.
When we were in the, you know, recent independent albums we've been doing with Small Town Poets, our producer Matt Goldman, there'd be times when we'd be like, guys, that's just not working. And he's like, you could do that, but if you want to do something that's cool, I wouldn't do that, you know?
That's such a good way to just hurry you along.
Yeah, so it's like the idea is that there's times when we're like, man, we just need to go with it. But there'd be times when we're like, hey, this isn't really vibing. Or there, especially parts when you kind of get in your own, I don't know, echo chamber as a band. If you have a band where you're like, oh, this is amazing. And you kind of bought into your idea. And then someone who's got an outside opinion is like, it's not amazing. Let's change this and this and this. So it's good to have that honest feedback.
Yeah, and we've talked about that a lot before. But if they disagree, it doesn't necessarily mean they're right. But if their disagreement resonates with you in that way that I'm always obsessed with the idea that we lie to ourselves a lot, but deep down we know the truth, like you feel like the producer's onto something with their critique or whatever, like that's what you're paying them for. So
yeah. There's times where
I've
been like,
to trust.
Yeah. There's times where I'm like, no, this is fine. He's like, okay. All right. It's not my thing, but that's cool. And sometimes it's not everyone's thing. So as far as what a producer should help with, they could help with any of the following. They could suggest arrangement improvements to the song. Sometimes they'll help out with co-writing a song. Sometimes that's where, like I said, in Nashville, you'll find some producers that haven't really engineered because they've come up sort of through the co-writing ranks and helped songwriters get a song out there ready to pitch, and then they kind of build up a reputation. So sometimes they might help co-write the song or suggest lyrical ideas. It's good to know if someone's going to lean that way before you get involved with them, because that's probably not the norm, but suggesting arrangement improvements is absolutely the norm. They'll help develop specific sounds for the album, the track, or the individual instruments. Like if there's an overall vibe you want for the whole collection of songs or a very specific track, it's like this song should be this kind of rock song that has this kind of drive or this kind of tones, and that's how it's going to fit in the album. Or with individual instruments, you know, talking about drums is a big one. A lot of producers have very different drum sounds they go to that they prefer, that can really dictate the sound of the album, or guitar sounds or synth sounds, or even how they approach recording vocals. And sometimes a producer will play some of the instruments. Sometimes they'll be a multi-instrumentalist, and it's helpful if they get in there and play something. A producer is usually responsible for hiring session musicians as well. So if you need a song's your four-piece rock band, you don't have a keyboard player, but this song really needs some organ, they would probably hire the organ player unless you knew somebody. They'd probably go, I know this guy. He'll come in and lay this track down in an hour. We'll have it. It'll be amazing. I'll call him and hire him, and we'll take care of that. So those are some of the things. Oh, go ahead.
I just had a note on that one. I can imagine some people would be like, oh, cool, that's great. They do that work. They hire people. And some other people might be like, no, screw that. Like, I need my guys and my. But there is something to be said for that relationship a producer has with a certain group of players, because you know they've already figured out how to communicate, how to get to good ideas quickly. You know, egos are generally way less of an issue when someone's got that rapport with. And so my friend Rob Stroop owned a studio in Oregon, and now he lives in New Mexico where he's building a new one. But when I was in Oregon, I was sort of part of his, like, we had some like wrecking crew type name. It was like, you know, six or seven guys that played on all those records for people that came and didn't have a band and were like, I want it to be good. I want really good players. I want stuff happening. And he'd be like, well, I got my guys. And generally that's who we brought in. We made stuff quick, but it was always good. So yeah.
Yeah, I think that's a good point of why you might want to rely on them, especially if it's a reputable producer, someone who's been working for a while. When they bring in studio guys, typically They know the drill. The drummer knows how to set up his drums the way the producer likes it. The guitar player knows some things, and the communication piece is huge. Because half the time in the studio, when you're working with new people, it's figuring out how to communicate ideas in a way that makes sense to each other. So the last thing I had under what should I expect from working with a producer slash engineer is you absolutely should expect that they will give you the files when done. Period. Period.
As long as you've paid them.
As long as you've paid them, yeah. Yeah, if you haven't paid them, that's their ransom. There right. should be no question. All you engineer producers saying that you own the files, shame on you. That is not how it works. Any reputable producer engineer, that won't even be a question. They'll just...
And I get this question on the blog all the time in the hip-hop world where the artist is saying, my producer's holding the tracks, blah, 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 all this stuff. There's like all these legal considerations that are happening now that the song is finished. That's maybe another thing is like, get this stuff. If you're going to be collaborating on something and it's not clear up front that the sound recording is yours and how you're going to split up the publishing for the songwriting, like, you might get in trouble. So try to get all this stuff ironed out beforehand. And even if the producer does technically like own the sound recording in like a beat making sense, like a hip hop guy creates the music, sends it to you to sing on or to rap on or whatever, like you don't want that guy licensing the same track to like 20 different artists. So you still need to get down to the discussion of like at the beginning, like who's going to own this and kind of take charge of distributing it, promoting it, all that stuff. And it probably should be the artist.
Yeah, that's a very good point because in the hip hop, EDM, that kind of world where, especially hip hop where and pop, where someone might be creating the beats and the bass line and like the whole section, maybe for a chorus or what's considered the verse in that song. Yeah, that person should claim some songwriter ownership and maybe even some of the recording owner, the sound recording ownership, but you need to get that in writing, make that clear up front. And also, like you said, I think that's really critical, the licensing it, because we get so many hip hop artists that get mad at us because we claim their track on YouTube because someone wanted us to monetize it on YouTube. And they're like, I didn't ask you to do that, or that's mine. And what it, really the problem is that person that produced the track for them used that same beat on 20 different albums and all that music is out there and it just confuses the system. So you need to make sure you understand in those cases what's happening with your music. But outside of that situation, you should have no problem getting the files. In fact, it's standard practice for you to show up to the studio with your own external hard drive, plug it into their computer, all the session work goes onto your hard drive, and when you're done, you can walk away with it. Even every night, if you wanted to. But that's something that you should expect, and you might want to ask that. So that kind of leads us into the next section, what we're going to talk about. What are some of the questions you should be asking or things that you should be doing beforehand? Before you say, yes, let's start recording, let's plan for starting on X date. So I'll hit a few of these and then you can jump in, Chris, with a few of them. One, how do you like to run a recording session or a project? You know, just understanding a person's work style is very important. What hours do you like to work? That is one thing that, you know, you could find out that this person you want to work with hates working at night, but that's the only time you're available and they feel like they're at their best during the day. That might be a consideration, or that the expectation is that they don't work at night or they only work at night and they prefer to work from 10 p.m. to 3 a.m. You know, some of those things, it's just good to be out in the open about. How do you like to approach the recording process? Do you expect the band to play everything down live? Are you somebody that just does everything individually, or what's their style? That could really dictate how the record feels to you as an artist and how it goes and maybe what you're comfortable with. Really important, what projects have you recorded recently? And getting a sense for some of the things that they've been into lately, because sometimes some of the credits that you find for them online may be pretty outdated. You want to hit on some of these? Do you have that list in front of you?
Yeah, I do. I wanted to make a few comments on those too, though. the approach to the recording in some ways might be dictated by your own circumstances. Do you have
True.
A band?
Absolutely.
Are you going to be tracking a lot of stuff kind of one at a time? But you should definitely be sure that the engineer slash producer is comfortable with that approach, because you might have someone like T-Bone Burnett, who's like all about vibe and capturing as much live as possible, and you want to make like a pristine pop record. Like, maybe that's not the best pairing. So that was one thing. You'd mentioned what have you recorded recently. A lot of engineers and producers and studios will have their discography on their sites. And like, you could seek out testimonials from other bands, but maybe that's a good idea. I feel like if you go to a studio site or a producer and you see they've recorded like a bunch of stuff recently, like, especially if one act has made multiple records with them, like, that kind of speaks for itself a lot of times. What else was, you'd said, about the session files, to go back to that previous point. It's worth discussing up front, if you can, what happens if you decide to take those files elsewhere to, maybe go in a different direction with the production, or maybe like you got all the way to the end and this engineer mixed it and now you're not psyched with the mixes, but you really like the tracking part of it, or you like the production direction, but now it's time. Like, you don't want to deal with someone who's going to get all hurt feelings. And like, I mean, I guess hurt feelings maybe are unavoidable. You're saying, I love everything you did, but this, no. But you definitely want someone who can be like, okay, cool. Here's your project. This is yours. So you can do whatever you want with it.
I've actually worked with like Matt, who's produced our independent small town poet records. He absolutely does not like mastering anything that he's recorded, but sometimes he doesn't like mixing what he's recorded. And I've worked with other situations where the person who produced it doesn't like mixing it because
they kind of lost perspective at that point.
Yeah. So that is something that you might ask, like, they may not like to mix it, or they might mix it. But it's probably not a good idea to have them produce it, mix it, and master it. It's probably good to have someone else do the mastering process. But those are some things to ask. I mentioned touring the studio ahead of time. That's always a nice way to just prepare yourself mentally.
One that interested me a lot in this list is what pre-production do you expect to have happened? Like, is the producer willing and available to work out this arrangement stuff with the band or the artist before you step foot in the studio? Did they expect you to have everything ready to go? That is a really important one.
Yeah, because they may be expecting that you walk in ready to play the song down top to bottom. All the lyrics are done. Everything's basically just needs some final tweaking as far as the arrangement and then, you know, figuring out sounds and stuff. Or you could walk in with your band, but you've got this new song that you just wrote with chords and you can play it down on acoustic guitar, but we got to figure out the whole band arrangement and we've got lead sheets, or maybe you don't even have that. You know, maybe they're expecting you to walk in with session files ready to go that they can just open and we can start recording. And they don't have to sit there and figure out the click and all that kind of junk. It's just important to find that out because, you know, if there's certain things you can do ahead of time, it just saves you money. But if it's things that they're like, don't do that, I have my own way of doing it, then you're just wasting your time too. So it's important to have those conversations. You know, we said ask to observe a session, what type of albums they like working on. You know, they might get a little cagey here because they want your business. But, you know, it's funny because, you know, I've mentioned Matt a lot that we worked with on the Small Town Poets independent stuff. When you walked into a studio, there was all these gold and platinum records for metal bands. And he just got really good at making metal recordings and got this reputation. But that's not what he likes to do. And so it was funny because it's...
Careful
it's
just, what you wish for.
Yeah. So just because they've got certain things that are successful may not be what they truly like are passionate about as far as making a record. So it might be worth asking that.
I like you have make sure the credits are legit. That is a good one because maybe this contradicts what I said earlier about not getting testimonials or referrals from other bands, but there are a lot of like insecure, I will peg them generally as older men who pretend that they've had, you know, all this whatever experience in this realm, and they claim to have done things that they haven't, just so that they can have the young 20-year-old folk singer or whatever come in and yeah, there's a strange amount of lying in this business.
Yeah, and there's somebody I have in mind who will remain nameless, who has a decent selling book out there, that has claimed to have produced a lot of albums, but in reality, or worked on a lot of albums, but in reality, like Madonna, in reality, they were like the second or third engineer who probably was responsible for wrapping cables and cleaning up the studio after the session was over. Those are the kind of fake credits that are, when I say that, make sure the credits are legit. Yeah, they could say they worked on those sessions, but did they really do anything of consequence? There's a lot of people that were like, I was in the room, so I worked on that project, and they'll use that to get business. And when they really didn't do anything creatively as far as directing that project and having a hand in how it sounded. So that's what I mean when looking to make sure the credits are legit. How payments will work. This was something Chris threw on the list that I thought was a good one. Like, is it going to be hourly? Is it going to be per song, per album? Are they going to want percentage points? It's typically unlikely that in an independent world, you're going to get asked for percentage points. But whether or not it's per song or hourly, and even if they say it's per song, well, what does that mean? What if the song takes 5 days compared to one day?
Well, that's where a lot of people get in trouble too. Like, they'll decide on some sort of per song rate, but then like the engineer is like, oh, well, I didn't know the song was going to take more than 3 hours. So like, we're done there. And then you have to like renegotiate, or vice versa. The artist doesn't know the song is going to take 5 days. And suddenly the producer's like, what the hell did I get into? These people can't make decisions.
And a lot of that comes down to like when that you met with that one producer engineer that you worked with, where he wanted to meet you and hear your music first, because he wants to see, is this somebody, one, I'm going to be able to vibe with and know how to get them what they want? And is it somebody that can pull off their song, so we're not spending, you know, 2 weeks just banging our heads against the wall? So sometimes that's what, you know, needs to be vetted ahead of time. So, let's see. Openly being able to discuss what happens if the sessions aren't working or the studio's not vibing and all those kind of things. And this, you know, we talked about discussing possibly having someone else mix. So let's move into, we got two more sections. Let me try and pick up the pace here a little bit, because the last one I think is the one that the fun one. Yeah. So how do I make sure I get what I'm looking for? So, and what I meant by this is that, you know, our friend over late night drinks, the biggest lament was that I don't think this sounds anything remotely like me and what I wanted and what I've expressed. And I'm very frustrated. And so here's my suggestions. I'll power through them. And then Chris, you can throw in yours. Have some reference albums that clearly point to the creative direction and sound you're looking for. Highlight any specific instrument sounds you like. Like if there's a particular guitar tone, or the way the drums and the bass and the guitars like have a lot of room, or maybe they're really tight sounding and dry, really being able to pinpoint those things so someone can go, oh, I have an idea of the ballpark that we're supposed to be landing in. Develop the songs as far as you possibly can. If there's a lot of things left for interpretation going into the session, that's going to be make it more of a challenge to get what you have in your head onto the recording. Don't be afraid to speak up. You know, this is one thing. It's like going back to, you're not their employee. Don't be afraid to speak up. If you don't like something, just say, you know what? I don't like this. And I'm very frustrated. And this isn't what I want. It, you know, you're paying a lot of money. You don't want to pay a lot of money and have music that you aren't passionate about because you didn't want to hurt someone's feelings. Buy a new hard drive just for the project. And, you know, it's also possible just to do a single with somebody as a test run. Let's just do a song, see how it goes. And if it goes well, we'll do the album and decide, you know, where, you know, the line is between you trusting your gut and being stubborn or being true to yourself. And sometimes you're wrong. And that's what makes it the most challenging. That's what I had for that section.
That's all good stuff. I moved from Oregon to Maine, you know, years back, and have not done a bunch of studio recording in my new home where I, well, out of my home I have, but I haven't gone to studios in Maine until recently. And I did a lot of what we're talking about to find the engineer I wanted to work with. And he basically was like, I've got this one day. And so I wanted to record more than one day, but I took the day because it's all. And then we recorded. We had a great day in the studio. And then I got an email a few days later like, hey, that was cool. Like, let me know if like you have a longer window of time if you want to keep working and stuff. But I was like, I wonder if he was just waiting to see if I was a jerk or like, you know, kind of your thing about doing a single song test run. In a way, I wonder if it was their way of testing me.
Might have been.
Might have been.
It's all just a big experiment.
Yeah.
All right. So,
now the fun part.
Yes. What are some of the warning signs to look out for? So there's probably lots of warning signs that didn't make the list, but these are some good ones that we thought of that some of these are by themselves are deal breakers. If you say this, boom, we're not working together. Some of them are just warning signs that you may want to do. Ask some of those deeper questions that we already talked about, but.
And unfortunately, any of these that are deal breakers, you might not hear until you're already working with the person.
Yeah. So if you're in it, it's like, make the best of it you can, but know that you're not alone. This has happened to many people, but the first one I had is they're protective of the session files. If they're protective of your intellectual property, especially in a way where, you know, again, where it's clear that it's your content, that to me is a deal breaker because I don't want to mess with somebody who's playing games with my content and trying to, you know, I don't know, do whatever they want with it. So that to me is a deal breaker.
Here's the next one. They claim they have an ownership stake in the project. No, they're not your label. You're paying them. Even if you're not paying them, if it's someone that's a friend or whatever, someone in your community, you should work out an ownership agreement where you're sharing in it or they're being paid on the back end somehow. They're not your label. They can't lock in your recordings.
Yeah. I've had many artists email me saying, hey, I went into the recording studio and before we started, they pulled out this contract for me to sign. And it basically said they retain ownership. They have the rights to it. I'm like, no, that's not what you're doing there. That's not a recording studio. That's someone that's trying to take advantage of independent artists. You were there just to produce. They're just helping you produce a record. And a lot of these guys will try and do it to like scam independent artists. And they'll just record a bunch of them and do it sometimes on the cheap, really cheap, but lock them into some rights. And so like if one hits, that then they can make a rights grab and claim all the money. It's, so it's something that if they're asking that, run. If they want you to sign any sort of contract that sounds more like a label or management deal breaker right there. Not going to work with them. Or try to tie up your rights in any way. If they're not a good listener or they're a hothead, you know, they may be have some amazing credits, but if it's like somebody that just isn't going to listen to you and a bit of a hothead, you're like, I can't deal with that kind of personality. Unless you like that kind of personality. Some people do, I guess.
The next one you have on here is they're overly opinionated, which I agree is a warning sign under certain conditions. Like if they are nitpicking and hate everything you're doing, like they're probably the one with the problem. Unless you're like not good or like,
well, yeah,
something's not working, in which case they might seem overly opinionated because what you're doing is not good and they really want to do their job.
Yeah. That one in and of itself is not a deal breaker. That one's like the true, like that's just a warning sign that, because it may not, that these warning signs aren't necessarily all that this person's trying to rip you off. Some of them are just like warning signs that things won't go well. So if you are finding that they're overly opinionated, like you're thinking, man, this guy just feels like he's overly opinionated. Maybe it's just a chance to take another you know, look at the situation. You know, fishy sounding credits. We talked about that. They get irritated with your questions or suggestions. So if this doesn't necessarily mean they're a hothead, but if it's like somebody that it's like when you try to contribute, they are just ignoring you or they get irritated or whatever, that's something to look for. Because clearly if communication is poor, you're not going to get a good good result. This last one was one of the other big laments we heard while in Montreal, or it's not the last one, but they do a bunch of work without you as if it's their project. So it feels like you're being kept in the dark.
This is troubling on so many levels to me. Like one, are they being paid for, are they clocking this time where they're just like up at night, every night for 2 weeks making nonsense that they add to your track? Like that's terrible. And two,
sometimes, yes.
Yeah, and if they're not being paid for that time, it's also terrible because now they've put in a bunch of their own sweat, equity, and skill and talent in their own mind. And so then when you hear the product and you're like, oh, that is not the direction I want to go in, now they're really going to have hurt feelings because what the hell? I just did all this for free. How dare you?
Which is
that's why I like... Artists should be in the room with the producer making decisions as you go. And when it's the end of the day, you should probably leave the session alone. I mean, to a degree, you can work separately to some degree, but you need to be making decisions in succession.
This is the exact one of the big, big points that our friend, our poor friend, finds herself in is that, it seems like the producer wants to make a pop record. She's not a pop artist. She wanted a totally different record. She goes away, comes back, and there's all these weird things done to her voice, all these extra instruments, like tons of instruments that weren't needed or wanted, didn't ask for. And when they're asked to remove mega, mega hurt feelings and defensiveness on the producer's part. And that is a sign of like, that's not your project anymore. They're trying to make it their project. And to me, that feels like that can happen in smaller markets more often because it's like a producer may have a certain vision of like the kind of music they want to make, but there's a smaller pool of artists that use their services. And so they're just wanting to do what they want to do, but they need artists to do it. And so you kind of find yourself in service of them. That is not normal. Now, what is normal, I will say, is... you know, like at the end of the day with sessions, it's completely normal for the engineer or producer to say, hey, you know what? I'm going to clean up these tracks tonight. So they're ready to go in the morning. And that might mean like doing some edits that we're all aware that are going to happen, comping a vocal, maybe tuning something. In our case, the engineer, the producer liked to run, even though we were recording guitar tracks off the amp, he would also record a direct line. So it's easy to reamp and try different sounds. So sometimes he might mess with that on a, you know, what we've talked about. I'm going to mess with this sound a little bit and see if we can dial it in a little bit closer. All those things are the kind of things that, yeah, they're working on overnight or before we come back the next day. Perfectly normal, acceptable. We'd never have walked into the studio to find a totally different song.
Right.
Like, hey guys, I turned this into a, you know, a jazz tune while you guys were gone. That's not normal.
I'm thinking now, like if it's a rare occasion and they have the right attitude about it, it could be fine. Cause I'm thinking of a co-writing situation where someone sent me a demo with a few verses and I like went crazy. I took the ball and ran with it and I changed the lyrics to some parts. I added this super ornate chorus and all the, you know, it was a very different song. And I did that in a matter of like a day or two. And I sent it to him and I was like, I realize I just went nuts on this, but I'm not attached to it. Like, feel free to take whatever you want, discard whatever you want. Like, this is still your song, but here's a bunch of like more ideas than you ever asked for. And I feel like if a producer did something similar, like one night, like went and added a bunch of stuff. And then the next day you listened and it wasn't quite what you wanted, then like hopefully they're attuned to not being attached to what they did. And also they'll learn, okay, I shouldn't do this so much if this person, you know, is going to not enjoy what I've done.
Yeah. Yeah. That's something. Yeah. It also, a lot of that comes with trust over time. Once you've worked with somebody a few times, that you have that working relationship, that those things can be perfectly acceptable and normal. It's just, it's not normal to walk into a studio and work with someone for the first time, track one thing, come back the next day, and it be something totally different without any sort of discussion or, you know, conversation like what you just said. Another big warning sign is if they're just a frustrated artist.
Aren't we all?
Yes, but that's a big warning sign if they really want to be the artist. Like, maybe, you know, they're just frustrated.
Even successful artists are frustrated artists.
We'll always be frustrated. That's why we're artists. But,
no, I know exactly what you mean. They haven't been able to scratch the itch that they have in their mind about what should have been their life, and now they're going to take it out on you and be like the brilliant figure that's going to control your recording and
yeah, exactly.
To prove something.
Like, yeah. And lastly, on the list that I have is another warning sign, and like this one is not one of the deal breakers, but it's something that is worth checking out, is if someone that doesn't manage time well, like if they suck at managing time, that might be a warning sign that you're not going to get what you want because you waste a lot of time. It's real easy to waste time in the studio. Sometimes I'm the most guilty person of it, because it's like you spend 2 hours tracking and you just need a mental break, and then it's easy to just want to chit chat for a half hour or suddenly go make a food run that is only supposed to take a half hour, but suddenly 2 hours later, you're still just hanging out, goofing off. And it's like, yeah, it's looking for someone that can help manage the time, because that's, you know, it is money in the studio.
Yeah. I have one more thing to add about warning signs. And
all right, go for
it. I think I'm about to piss off most hip hop beat makers and producers, but I think, that when you see someone offering you the exclusive right to a beat or to a track or whatever, that in and of itself to me is a warning sign, because you then realize that this person works in a, what would you say? A kind of a workflow or a process where they're used to making something and then trying to get lots of people to use it. And okay, so now you can pay them extra for the exclusive right to that thing. But okay, great. Now they pay you, or you pay them rather, if you're the artist, you pay that beat maker more money for the exclusive right to that beat. But guess what? It's not exclusive, because in the digital age, anything can be copied instantly. So the other 12 people who are using that beat already have stuff on YouTube or whatever. And now, like you were saying, the YouTube content ID problem you mentioned earlier, like your exclusivity is worthless. Like, yeah, you paid for it, but you're not getting it because someone beat you to it on YouTube. And so I just think that the whole licensing beats is, I know that's the way it's done. And so I feel bad like critiquing that, but like it just causes so many problems from a monetization standpoint. And like, why not try to find someone who's willing to create something new for you under the understanding right from the beginning that this is just for you. You guys are collaborating on something. It's unique. They're not going to repurpose that to sell it to other artists.
Yeah, that's, I think, a good point. We see, like I said, we see so many people getting frustrated, and it's only going to get worse with Instagram and Facebook monetization cranking up, that your content needs to be your content. If it's sharing with anyone, it's just going to cause monetization problems. And what happens, it's not like somebody gets the money and somebody doesn't. It just, nobody gets the money, because when there's a conflict, they just don't pay until they can figure out who's owed the money. So that's something that is important. Yeah, I think collaborating with that person, you know, there's plenty of beat makers and people that produce tracks like that, that have strong reputations, that people hire them just to work on their own project and create something fresh and new for that project. And it's not something where they're just selling them, licensing them, because it's really hard to know if something is really exclusive in a digital world, because if it's out there in any way, it can be reproduced and show up places. So
yeah, and I guess if it is truly exclusive, if you define that so literally, and the producer does, then great. Then you have the only access to that bit of intellectual property. Sweet, that's good. But a lot of times exclusivity gets sold as this thing to artists, and you can't have exclusivity retroactively. If 12 other people already licensed that beat temporarily or whatever, like,
yeah,
then there's no such thing as exclusivity anymore.
Yes, correct. Well, I hope that conversation helps, especially those of you who maybe have had a experience that left you wondering, what is it supposed to really be like? Or what, am I alone in this? Did I just get totally ripped off? And am I, and you know, sometimes you feel silly in those situations. And I know that's one situation with our friend that was telling us that they just kind of felt silly. And you're like, no, you don't feel silly. This happens all the time. And it's unfortunate, but So I thought this would make a good topic for the podcast. I hope it helps. If you've got some suggestions or some horror stories about working with a producer engineer, we'd love to hear them. 360-524-2209 is our listener line. And then the email is podcast@cdbabypodcast.com. And I'm going to put out the encouragement for the ladies again to send your feedback. Since I asked before, we've seen an uptick in emails and calls from the women in the audience, which I appreciate. Thanks for throwing your two cents in there. And we've got a call. We've got some calls and emails from them as well. So I appreciate it. But
can I throw in one more thought about producers? Sorry to...
Sure. Yes. Chris, go ahead. You're our first one giving feedback on the episode.
Right. Okay, so I think that a producer's job, besides just creating good recordings, is also to some degree to be the counselor, the psychologist for the artist. And I know they don't like that, but it is kind of a reality of working in a collaborative situation. And so another thing is, if they are berating you or not sensitive to your needs, or they're yelling at you, like, all of that is like red flag. And I've heard from a lot of people horror stories about that. So they should be sensitive to your needs, as your emotional needs, not just your needs as a creator of music.
Yeah, and that definitely stems to like personality types. And then I think that you know, when Miguel, our bass player, was working with that other artist who was getting ready to record her first record for a major label, and he played on it, and he had some of that experience. And so I was terrified going into our first, you know, label album, thinking, oh man, I'm just gonna be yelled at all day. So yeah, it is something that you should be, you know, however you like to work, and you want to work with somebody that can create a positive creative environment. And depending on who you are, that can mean many different things, but you do want to feel comfortable. Most people don't create their best music under extreme stress. But I'm not going to say that it's not possible. So, anyway, yeah. All right. Yes. Again, 360. Oh shoot. Where'd my notes go? 360-524-2209 is the number. Please call or podcast at cdbabypodcast.com. And, let's see. I've got two emails and two calls. Let's start with the calls. And I will say, I'm going to play two calls. They came into the voicemail box in this exact order, one right after the other. I did not change anything, even though people probably won't believe me. But here we go. So there's one caller called in and someone else called in and basically answered their call for them. So here we go.
Hi, my name is Brock. I'm involved in a local Portland, Oregon band. I was just curious because we've been using a service other than yours to distribute our new record. You're probably familiar with Amuse. It's one of those options that says, hey, we'll take your record and put it up on the internet for free. So the problem with Amuse is that we posted our record about a month ago, and it still hasn't shown up in the Apple Music Store. And that's a place where a bunch of our fans and friends would like to listen to it, but they can't yet. Customer service has been, you know, marginally responsive, but no results yet. And don't blame me. I tried to push CD Baby because I know you guys do it right, but so it goes. So my question for you is this. Given that we're having these distribution problems, what do you know about other services? I know Discoid is one that people have mentioned, and then, of course, your fine service, which I would prefer that we use, but how can I convince my bandmates that you're the one I should use? And what do you know about the other ones? Thanks.
Well, before I play the next call, Brock, I'm going to say I'm not going to be able to give you advice on the CD Baby DIY Musician podcast about other distribution services. I'm sorry. But here was the call that came in right after that. And then we'll address both of them.
Hey, guys. My name is Annie LaFleur. I don't have a question for you, but I just have a lot of love for CD Baby. I am releasing my first single ever, and I'm so green to this whole process. And I have researched endlessly on who I should go with as far as CD Baby or DistroKid or all of the numerous other people that I could release my music through. And I have to say, you guys are top notch. I have listened to the podcast. I feel like you guys are my best friends because I listen to you all the time. And I just got everything done with setting up my single through CD Baby today, and the customer service was top notch. I didn't feel like I was asking stupid questions, and the things that I needed help with, they were done in a timely manner. So I just wanted to say thank you. I feel so confident in my choice with going with CD Baby, and you guys are proving yourself to be the best. So I just wanted to send some love. Thank you so much for the podcast. And again, my name is Annie LaFleur. If you guys want to check out my song, it'll be coming out February 15th, and it's called Dumb. Not a great song title, but hopefully a great song. I hope you guys have a great day. Thank you again. Bye.
So this is why we need the ladies to call in, because clearly they have it together.
They do their research.
And they can make a confident decision, just like she said. Brock is in the band. Apparently, he needs to break up with this band because he knows the right answer, and they're doing this and that, and he can't get them on board with the. It just cracked me up that. First off, I have to comment that whatever you do in the distribution space, please know that it's like any other business. You're gonna get what you pay for. If you pay nothing, and nothing is expected in return for the service, you're going to get nothing in return. So don't be surprised when you go to some service that says that they don't take a fee, or they have next to zero back end and don't make any money, that for them not to be invested in you. And that's why I like the CD Baby model, because we make money when you make money. So we want to make darn sure that your music's monetized properly. We want to make sure that it gets out there when it needs to get out there. We want to make sure you have all the monetization options possible, because we want you to make money. And the best part is we're a partner in that success. So we're motivated to make sure you're, you know, where you need to be.
And not just getting the music out, but keeping it out forever without you ever having to out of pocket. You know, call
yes.
up more money for it. So, you know, as your catalog grows, you have no additional cost beyond just what we make when you make money. So there's sort of no risk for continually putting out new music.
Yeah. And also, we've been paying artists weekly for 21 years. And that's something no one else can say. And
hey, we can drink now.
That's right. CD. Well, it's technically April, I think. So we got a month. Month and a half. But yeah, that's something that, you know, a lot of these services that pop up that you see out there claiming to be free or this or that, they've never even paid an artist. And I will tell you, this is something I won't say everywhere, but I'll tell you on the podcast, many of them a year later come to us begging us to take their catalog because they can't figure out how to pay people. They figured out how to push files. That's the easy part. But getting millions of lines of data to match up properly to make sure artists get the money they're owed is a challenge. And we have a giant team here that does that. So we don't mess around with that. And, you know, if you don't have to dig very deep to find lots of distributors having payment problems. So That's all we'll say on that. I just thought those two calls were funny, that someone calls in frustrated, can't get their band on board. And then someone right after that called in said, I did the research. This was the right choice. And I'm a happy camper. So there you have it. Those are the calls for today.
And thanks for listening to us. I'm glad we feel like friends. That's always nice to hear.
And Brock, you should know that I only make jabs and make sarcastic comments to people I like. So sarcasm and teasing are my love languages. So if I feel comfortable teasing and making sarcastic jabs, you know, that just means I like you. So if I don't, then there's problems. Let's go on to some emails. We got a couple good emails, and this is, again, sort of a theme of a question that keeps popping up, but it was asked in a slightly different way, and I got the experts here to answer it for me. So here goes. Hey, Kevin and Chris. Some months ago, I released a couple singles as to promote a Kickstarter campaign to finish my full-length album. I'm happy to say that it did get funded, and now the album is almost done. My problem now is that the new mixes of the already released singles sound miles better than the previous versions. My audience is still relatively small but strong, and I think this album will be a huge opportunity to reach a bigger audience, and I want to put my best foot forward. What would you do in this case? Is there a way to upload a new mix to streaming services of already released songs without making them an entirely new release so that I can keep the plays, ISRCs? I keep the plays intact is what he's saying by using the same ISRC codes. Should I just take the singles down when the album drops? I know it's typically smarter not to take down your old music, but these new mixes would be the same exact songs, just mixed significantly better. Thanks for all that you do and for all the knowledge that you've shared via the podcast and the conference and for just being generally cool cats. I guess it's a typo. He said coot cats, but I don't know what a coot cat is. So Best Dylan, and his goes by the artist name, Hello, I'm Dylan. So I asked someone here at work who deals with this kind of stuff, since he said they were significantly different mixes. Had he said he just mastered them different, I probably would have a different answer. But this is what MJ said here, who runs that department that handles this kind of stuff. New mixes would be a new song with a new ISRC, as the audio fingerprint profile has changed in that case. Unfortunately, the best steps are to start a new submission if the new mixes are to be used. This is a central reason why we strongly push all of the "Are you sure this is the final audio?" type questions during the sign-up and through the process. The only time I'd replace audio for an existing ISRC is if the audio had been cut off or there was some kind of digital artifact that occurred during the process. So in this case, I think what he pointed to, like the digital fingerprint being different, is the important fact that if you've got a different mix, not just that it's mastered slightly better, those digital fingerprints are probably going to be identical still, but if you've mixed it where it sounds totally different, new track, get, just release it on your album with new ISRC codes. In your case, you were going to have a new album anyway, so it shouldn't be any different as far as that goes, but just make sure the ISRC codes are new. And, you know, it's up to you if you want to leave the old ones up or not. If they got any traction at all, or, you know, fans saved them, or they put them in a playlist or something, I'd leave them live because they'll just magically disappear from their library and they might go looking for them and be like, what happened to that track? It's gone. So it's your call on that. I'd say just leave them live. All right. One more email. This one's a bit longer, but hang in there. And Chris, I'm looking to you to supply the answers for this one.
Oh, okay. I'll listen intently.
Hi, Kevin. I listened to dozens of your podcast episodes over the past 2 years or so. The topics you cover are highly relevant, and the way you discuss and tackle the challenges of independent musicians is both refreshing and meaningful. Last but not least, I really enjoy your sense of humor. There's no comparable podcast or community across Europe. That's why I found it exciting to hear about you guys going to Valencia last spring. I wish I could have attended the conference, but it overlapped with our touring album release schedule. Please keep up the great work. So last fall, you and Kristen Ford made an insightful podcast episode on touring across Europe. We're a Berlin-based Americana roots band consisting of an American, a Chilean, and a German. It's called St. Beaufort. And he puts a YouTube link in there. We're with a booker for Germany and Italy now. But for almost 4 years, however, we booked our gigs ourselves and got to play some 150 shows in 10 countries. I noticed that we actually followed several of Kristen's pieces of advice on our booking tours in Europe. Our plan is to do this the other way around now, that is, to play our Americana music in the U.S. for a tour in April, May 2020. Before spending several weeks or months on the booking process, we wanted to at least try to find an American booker that works with unknown European touring acts from a folk background, similar to what we've experienced with our Italian booker. We don't expect to make a lot of money on the tour, obviously. We are also aware of tedious and expensive visa processes. People told us it might be worth attending conferences such as Folk Alliance Conference that take place in Montreal next month. Obviously, that already happened. But needless to say, flying the band over to the U.S. for a showcase is quite an expense. That's why I wanted to get in touch with you guys to find out. And here's his questions. Number one, do you plan to do a How to Book a Tour in the U.S. as an Independent International Musician episode? I think this could be highly valuable for your European community, which I understand you'd like to grow. Two, do you think playing a showcase at a folk conference for us is a smart decision, considering the large cost or even necessary to get a tour booker in the U.S. as an international act? Apart from the above, what do you recommend doing? If you find the time to read this and reply, thanks so much. If not, we still wish you the best of luck and success for future of the DIY Musician Podcast. Best, Henrik. What are your thoughts, Chris?
Stay in Europe.
Oh, really?
No, I'm just being cynical. Okay,
what, so sort of Trump supporter?
Quite the opposite. I wonder, without knowing sort of what stature they have, not only in Europe, but however that translates here. Like, do you know if you have listeners here? What's your analytics tell you about listenership here? Is there any Facebook presence here, or amongst awareness amongst your followers in the US here? Without knowing that, it's tough for me to say, but I feel like I was almost thinking, like, just book a tour on your own the way you did for 4 years in Europe before you had an agent, because I don't think there's going to be someone over here that wants to invest time in an unknown act to take a chance on that first tour. Maybe after you've been over here two or three times and you've proven that you're actually filling rooms and making money, then there's a hook. You know, again, unless you know, you've looked at the data and you know you can get people into the venues over here. But if it's kind of like a expedition, like you're testing the waters, I'd try to just book your own tour. That being said, I would a European act always has more more interest or intrigue than
more Joe cachet. Schmo's
band from yeah cachet exactly than you know your local rock band that just wants a gig. So I think it's definitely going to be possible and probably easy for you to book your own tour here.
I think if you're just trying to establish that you're a European band, that you've made it to the U.S. and played some, that there's some ways you can do it. And can do it affordably to establish, like, we've played here before. But how about his part of the question of Folk Alliance?
So that one, not sure of the stature of the band over there and how that gets broadcast over here. But what I see generally happening in the Folk Alliance world is that you go and you kind of meet people, you play some unofficial showcases, and then you go again, and then maybe, 3 years down the line, you get an official showcase or whatever. Like, and those are the ones in front of, you know, kind of in a big room in front of lots of people. If you want to come over and do, 15 guerrilla showcases, which are the ones in the small hotel rooms, and you work your ass off to get relevant bookers and house concert hosts and stuff to your small showcases, then I think that could be definitely worth it. But one thing to be aware of in the Folk Alliance world is that when you come in, if you were to go to New Orleans in 2020, a lot of the business you're going to be drumming up for gigs probably is happening a year or even more later, because a lot of people in the folk world have their things, their schedule is booked out a year or more. So it might not be a quick return.
Yeah. And I don't know about the visa situation. The hard thing about addressing that on the podcast is it can be very different depending on what country you're coming from. I think everything from the EU is the same, treated the same coming to the US. So that I might be able to find out and pass along the information on what you need to do. I know from Canada, coming to the US from Canada is really, really tough. Apparently the opposite direction has become extremely simplified, where it's a lot easier for US artists now to play in Canada, like the whatever the people had to do to get permission. I don't know. That's what I've heard. But so it can be by country basis, and laws are constantly changing, but we might be able to do something more European based. I'll ask some questions of people, and maybe when we're over in Valencia, we'll talk to some artists that are from Europe that have done it and see what some of the processes they had to go through. I would say two tips. I do a lot of travel for work and travel as a musician, and I will say two tips as far as cheap and affordable travel that you absolutely should know about is, one, there is an email list that just go to the website. It's called Scott's Cheap Flights. And I know that sounds really like questionable. Yeah. But it's not. And people that travel a lot, like there's myself and someone else here at CD Baby, we live and die on that email list. This is just a person that scours flight deals daily. And for example, there just the other day, there was for 24 hours only, there was a round trip ticket from Portland to Valencia, Spain for $495, which that is cheaper than what it cost me to fly round trip to Nashville from Portland. So there's stuff like that where you can subscribe, and you just got to keep your eye open for that kind of stuff. A lot of it you got to make a quick decision on. The other is Airbnb is amazing for band travel. Usually you got to spend more than two nights at a place, but if you're going to be in a certain area, it can be really an affordable option as opposed to staying in a hotel. And if there's more than one person and you've got gear, probably more secure than staying in hostels. But that's been an amazing thing for band travel, that there's been some trips that we've made as a band recently that we wouldn't have been able to afford if we were all staying in hotel rooms. But because of Airbnb, we were able to just all get an apartment with plenty of room for all of us and save a ton of money. So if you're not kind of aware of those two things, you should be.
And they might already be completely aware of this, but once you fly over here, it's worth being reminded of the distances between cities in certain regions of this country. So make sure if you've got limited time to come over and do an expeditionary tour, do it in a densely populated area where there's lots and lots of cities. So, you know, that could be the Northeast, it could be the Southeast, it could be maybe like Chicago, Minneapolis, Milwaukee, Indianapolis, that sort of region. Don't go to the Pacific Northwest, or even California.
Yeah, don't think you're going to go to New York and then LA and then, you know, Chicago in 3 days. Yeah, that's one thing when I talk to Europeans that have come over to the States for the first time, they're like, it's so big. Yes, it's especially when you get like past the Mississippi River, it starts to get really sparse until you get to the West Coast. And so booking tours can be a challenge. If you're coming to the DIY Musician Conference in Austin, there's a lot of major cities right there in Texas that it'd be really easy to get some good bookings really close by and use that as a jumping off point. San Antonio, Houston, Dallas, and Fort Worth, they're kind of sister cities. All those cities are massive and all within a few hours of each other. And then there's more cities that in between as well. And so that's looking at it like that of like, hey, I'm going to go to the States to this event and just use that as a jumping off point to all these other satellite cities. It's a good thing to try. And also, if you're coming to Austin in August, it's really a slow month for the city in that the University of Texas is not in school. A lot of the venues have openings. It's not their heavy tour season because of the college being out. A lot of people try to come through when college is in session because they're going to get a lot of those college students coming to shows. So it might be easy to get a gig in the Austin area if you start right now. And there's like a bazillion venues in Austin.
Good tip.
All right. I think we're good.
All
I
right.
I'm out of words.
We've just alienated ourselves from the music production community.
That's all right. They need us. Again, the DIY Musician Conference, we mentioned it. DIYMusicianCon.com. Go get your tickets for Valencia or Austin or both. Do it as soon as possible. Chris and I will be there. And we can hang out late night over drinks and listen to all your woes and troubles. We'll be there for you. We'll lend a listening ear.
We can be counselors too, yes. I just realized that as soon as you press stop on recording, I'm on vacation.
Really? And I will be on vacation.
Just keep recording.
I will be on vacation in one day. I've got one more day in the office. And then if you're listening to this podcast when it's fresh, I will probably be sitting on a beach in Lanikai, the Lanikai Beach outside of Kailua in Hawaii. And hopefully I will have a guitar with me. I ordered this travel guitar and it was supposed to arrive yesterday. And apparently they can't truck things in bad weather. And so I'm hoping I get it in time because I really wanted to sit on the beach and just play guitar and have everyone leave me alone.
That sounds ideal.
It does. All right. Well, next time we meet, Chris, in person, it'll be Valencia. Looking forward to it. And enjoyed being in Montreal with you. That was a good time.
That was fun. Glad we're on board for next year in New Orleans.
Yeah. Won't be cold in New Orleans, that's for sure. Won't be 2 feet of snow outside. And all right. Well, that's going to do it for this episode. We'll catch you next time.
See ya.
You've been listening to the CD Baby DIY Musician Podcast, broadcasting from Portland, Oregon, USA.